today I'm going to be talking about Galileo and the origins of the modern world. I imagine that you thought that when you heard Professor Perrone's lecture, right, that you were almost at the end of the story. Right? In 1633, Galileo was condemned, and even though he recanted, he was still sentenced to house arrest. He lived out the remainder of his life under house arrest for the first period in a villa outside of Florence, and then when his health failed, he moved to this villa of his, this house of his in Florence. He died in 1642, and he originally wasn't able to be buried, right, in an appropriate monument. In the 1700s, in the early 1700s, a monument was built for him that was appropriately magnificent. The cult of Galileo had grown so great that they, even when they moved his body, they took out his finger, his middle finger, and preserved it for posterity. And there is a detail of it, right? I wouldn't touch it. Yeah, you don't know where it's been. What I want to suggest to you is that far from the story being over, right, Galileo's real legacy, right, occurred in those 8 years when he was under house arrest, right? This old man with his eyesight failing, right, having, by the time he died, he was totally blind, dictating his notes to his assistants, and working over, right, the results of experiments that he'd performed earlier. These are some of his notes on motion, which would have eventually become his dialogues on the two new sciences. You can imagine this man well into his old age, right, health failing, unable to leave his bed, scribbling away at his mathematical calculations, right? Produced the dialogues on the two new sciences, sometimes called the discourse, right, on the two new sciences. And I'm going to suggest that work of that old man in his retirement, in some sense, changed the world, right, and was more important than the magnificent discoveries you heard about him making with the telescope, right? And more magnificent even than his defense of the Copernican hypothesis. Because in the scientific method that Galileo laid out, right, in his last years, we find the origins of the modern world. Right? The scientific method became the basis of the greatest reorganization of human society, right, that our the world has ever known. Right? In the next century, right, the century of the 1700s, which is going to be called the Enlightenment, which we'll study in the Jefferson unit. And on the basis of those new scientific principles, there was a renewed confidence in human reason to, on scientific principles, reorganize human societies and reorganize human life on the basis of this new knowledge. So the modern period, right, is the period directly after the scientific revolution, right, and it expressed a great confidence, right, in the power of science and the power of this new method that Galileo discovered to uncover the truth and to uncover truths about human nature and about morality upon which we can build a society. So in the next unit, in the Jefferson unit, we're going to be studying how Jefferson went about using Galileo's method for the first time to sort of form a government and form a society from scratch on the basis of human reason. And in the very next unit, when we get to Beethoven, we'll see that we're going to be looking at a move away from that method. Right? All of the different units we're going to consider in the rest of the semester are going to be framed by Galileo's scientific method, either accepting it and taking confidence in it to extend it further and further into the human domain, or reacting against it. Beethoven is going to react against the rigidity of this scientific method that we'll see, and instead argue for feeling, right, or passion or creativity as a better means of knowing the world. Right, when we get to the next semester, right, Darwin and Freud are going to be extending Galileo's method to life, right, and to the human, even to the human mind. Carnegie is going to be using the scientific method and technology, right, to make money and to make gather wealth and to produce goods for our society more effectively than ever. When we get to Picasso, right, we'll see that in some sense his artwork, as we'll show you today, is in some sense a caricature of the scientific method. And the Cubist paintings that we'll see in Picasso take their start from the way of seeing the world that Galileo first happened upon in the experiments that we'll look at today. And even in Camus, right, we'll see that he is going to be framing his philosophy as the attempt to find a place for human meaning, right, in the world, the new world that was revealed by Galileo. And so I'm going to suggest that Galileo's real legacy was this new method for gaining knowledge, right, and the alteration in our worldview, right, that this new method and the application of this new method caused. And so what I want to do first of all is show you what the new method was, because I think you may be mistaken in some ways in your impressions, in your first impressions of what the method of Galileo was and what scientific method is. And then I want to show you the results of that new method when applied to the world and when applied to human nature, and show how the transformation that Galileo started scribbling away in his villa was one of the most radical transformations of how we view the world that's ever occurred. And I want to argue that in some ways the world that we're living in now is a result of still coming to terms, right, with the effects of that method that Galileo invented. Right, so let's start talking about the scientific method. Let's start where we at the very beginning with Copernicus's insight. Copernicus recognized that the motion that you're seeing right now, right, the motion of the sun through the heavens, was not indeed in the sun, right, but was in the Earth's motion. Right? It was in fact that the motion we were seeing was the motion of the Earth rotating on its axis. Now, you may think that scientific method, right, from what we've heard so far, right, of Galileo making fun of the Aristotelians for not being willing to perform experiments, right, you may have thought that the scientific method involves sort of just using your senses and looking in the world and just seeing what's there, right, instead of just listening to the authority of past authors, of dead people. And it does indeed involve that, but we're going to see it doesn't just involve looking at the senses sort of passively, just accepting what's there, right, because indeed, Aristotle was right. If you trust your senses, by golly, it sure looks like the sun is moving, right? It doesn't look like it's the Earth's rotation. We say it's a beautiful sunrise. We don't say it's a beautiful Earth rotation. Right? The essence of the scientific method was to recognize that you can't trust the senses, right? That you have to use the mind to purify the senses and separate out what in the senses is merely relative to us. The motion that the sun had in the heavens was merely our motion as we stood on the earth that was revolving, and not the real absolute motion of the heavens. And so the two catchphrases I want you to remember about the scientific method is that they involve separating the relative from the absolute. You can't trust the senses, because what we see with the senses is merely relative to us. The scientific method, the Copernican revolution, right, was in essence seeing that the motion of the sun was merely relative motion, and we had to separate out, find the right point of view, right? Find the right way of looking at it with our senses. Right? So when we look at, now we know that when we look at the Earth, you know, from the heavens, that's a better point of view, right? And now we can see that in fact it's the Earth turning as we watch it revolve here. Right? This next image is just kind of cool to look at, right? This is a picture of the Earth at the same time each day for all 365 days of the year. And you can see what causes the seasons in this image as well. Right? It's the change of the tilt of the Earth's axis as it rotates around the sun changes the angle of the sun on the Earth as you go from summer to winter. Right, so we all know that Galileo defended the motion of the Earth around the sun, right? Rather than claiming that the sun moved around the Earth, moved through the sky each day. And he did that on the basis of recognizing you can't trust the senses. You have to separate the relative from the absolute. And the second catchphrase was that you have to learn to purify the appearances. Right? The surface appearances of things can't be trusted. Right? So there are two other Aristotelian principles of motion that Galileo is famous for refuting. And much of the work that I showed you that was published in the Dialogue on the Two New Science involved the refutation of those two principles. Aristotle, remember, had thought that heavy objects fall faster than light objects, right? Because they had more of the element Earth in them. They would be attracted to the center of the universe more strongly in their desire to get to their natural place than would lighter objects, would have had a mixture of, you know, air and fire and only a little bit of water mixed in, cotton. So it wouldn't be attracted as powerfully, and it would fall less slowly. Galileo was going to say that all objects fall at exactly the same rate, right? Aristotle was to say that in violent motion, an object would only move as long as there was a force applied to it. And when the force was taken off of it, the object would stop moving. And in natural motion, the object would move until it reached its natural place, and then it would stop. So Aristotle thought that an object in motion wouldn't tend to stay in motion. It would go to its natural place, or if you stopped applying force, it would wear out, its motion would wear out, its violent motion would wear out, and it would stop. Galileo was going to first formulate what would become one of Newton's laws, right, that an object in motion will tend to stay in motion, right, what we know now is the law of inertia. And let's look and see what, you know, what our senses tell us, right? So let's start with falling objects, right? Let's perform an experiment and see what the senses tell us, right? I'll drop a heavy bowling ball and a light piece of paper. Aristotle would say, bowling ball was going to hit the ground first. Galileo would say, bowling ball, paper hit the ground the same time. In this case, we recognize, right, that I think most of us know the reason for that, right, that you can't trust the senses as they are, right? What we see with our senses is really sort of an impure conglomeration of lots of different properties, right? We realize that the reason the paper didn't hit the ground first was because of air resistance, right? So if I crumple up the piece of paper, right, to make the friction of the air somewhat more similar, right, to the air resistance that the bowling ball experiences, and now I drop them at the same time, they hit the ground at more or less the same time. Right, we're going to see that the situation is even more complicated than that, right? Because this has about the same air resistance as the bowling ball, right? Right, but if I drop both of these at the same time, right, we already know what the answer is going to be, even though the air resistance is the same, right? We have to try this again. Sometimes the best of experimentalists, right, have to repeat their experiments. Right, the bowling ball still hits the ground, right, far before, right, the balloon does. Right, the air resistance of these are the same. They're the same shape. In a wind tunnel, they'd have the same resistance. Right? It turns out that there's other things involved there. Right, there's the buoyancy of the air. As well, just as a piece of wood floats in the water because it's lighter than the water it displaces. The balloon sort of is buoyed up by the air because of the weight of the air it displaces. So we realize that you can't just trust your senses. There's too many different causes involved in the falling of that object. Right? There's the actual gravitational pull, there's air resistance, and there's the buoyancy of the air. Right? In fact, the final proof had to wait till we got to the moon, right? Till in a more or less complete vacuum, one of the astronauts we'll see here dropped a hammer and a feather, and saw that indeed they fell at the same time.
And we thought that where would be a better place to confirm his findings than on the moon? And so we thought we'd try it here for you. The feather happens to be appropriately a falcon feather. For our falcon, and I'll drop the two of them here, and hopefully they'll hit the ground at the same time. How about that? Mr. Galileo was correct in his findings.
There you go. Sort of anticlimactic. It was like 5 minutes of build-up for a half a second of watching them fall, right? But you can say you saw it with your own eyes. Galileo proved right, right? The point, though, is that just as in that case we had to sort of purify the appearances by getting rid of all the extraneous causes, so the essence of the scientific method is to try to control reality, right? Not just to look at reality and take what it gives us, right? But to control reality, to purify it, right? To try to isolate out one pure form or one cause at a time, right? You're all familiar with the method of the controlled experiment that you learned in, say, fifth grade or sixth grade in grade school, where you leave one trial alone, right? And then you change the other properties of the experiment one by one. And so if there was an outbreak of sickness, you know, say in the dorms, right, just by looking at people getting sick, you wouldn't have any idea it was causing them to get sick, right? You'd have to It could be the water. It could be that some of the food that they were eating. It could be some toxin in their dorm room. It could be that they had contact with somebody who was carrying some illness. In order to determine what the real cause was, you'd have to simplify each situation. You have to find one person who only had the water. You have to find another person who only ate the food, another person who only lived in this dorm. And by manipulating the variables very carefully one by one, you would attempt to isolate out the pure form of that object. This is a picture of some of Galileo's experiments. You can see his inclined plane there that we're going to look at, a replica of which you see here. And in the back there's the pendulum that we're going to start to talk about now. Right, here's a picture of Galileo's inclined plane, a sort of romanticized picture, everybody around, you know, watching him drop his balls down the plane, as we will in just a second. I want to talk about the pendulum, the first of the experiments, the famous experiments that Galileo performed, and we'll see how that was used by Galileo as a purification of the appearances, a purification of the senses, that was going to allow him, was actually his best refutation of Aristotle, that heavy objects and light objects fall at the same rate. And it was also one of the clearest illustrations of the other principle that I mentioned. I'll set this going. Remember I said that Aristotle believed that when you set an object in motion, it doesn't stay in motion, whereas Galileo said that when an object is set in motion, it will stay in motion. So again, let's look and see what our senses tell us. I'll set the object in motion. And he was happy, that it didn't continue to stay in motion, But in general, our senses and our common sense experience tell us that when an object is set in motion, it goes for a little while, and then it stops, Again, we sort of know now that the cause of that is air resistance or friction of the air, That there's always some other force intervening, The world is a messy world, and there are always other forces and other causes, getting in the way of the forms that we want to measure, the forms that we're interested in. So the essence of the scientific method was to control reality so as to isolate out those pure forms, to almost approximate Plato's theory of forms, by separating each causal influence from all the others. So you may wonder, if Galileo's interested in why objects fall, he's interested in why objects fall from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, why is it that pendulums would pique his interest? Why is it supposedly during a boring service at the cathedral in Pisa, he glanced up at this lamp and noticed it swaying, just in the same way some of you may have noticed this swaying, which I provided for your entertainment in case the lecture got boring, and noticed that as it wore down, as the swing of the pendulum wore down, that its period remained the same. Now, to us, we may not have even noticed that, or we may not have even understood its significance. But when Galileo saw that invariance, he saw that there's something that doesn't change. The period of the pendulum remains the same, even as it wears down. So if you sort of count one, two, three, four. If we remember that rhythm, you'll do some of these experiments in your seminars. Remember that rhythm. Now, if we start it much further, one, two, three, four. The time it takes to make a swing pretty much remains the same. And you'll notice that the pendulum almost returns to the same height from which it dropped. Galileo, even though we may not see it, Galileo saw that as a clear proof of the law of inertia, that an object in motion tends to retain its motion unless something gets in the way of it. And the small deviation, the small little bit that it decreases each time, is easily attributable to friction, since the better you build your pendulum with less friction, the less it wears out. The heavy pendulums will wear down less than the light ones. So Galileo saw that properties like that that don't change, the period of the pendulum, we'll see, doesn't change with the amplitude, and we'll see it doesn't even change with the mass. He was also going to use it to prove that heavy objects and light objects fall at the same rate. He said that instead of trying to drop heavy and light objects from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, I didn't drop, my paper and my bowling ball high enough, but if I dropped them from high enough, there would be a small deviation, The heavy object would actually fall a little bit faster. So dropping objects from the tower, Leaning Tower of Pisa, as it was reputed that some of Galileo's students did, didn't really work out too well. Right? The fall was too fast to measure accurately, and heavy objects in air just do fall a little bit faster, right? than light objects, right? Because of the air resistance or effects of buoyancy, which are hard to eliminate completely. So Galileo sought to isolate out those properties in some of these other experiments. And I can show you now in the case of this pendulum, he said that instead of dropping the ball one long time, instead, repeat many times the fall through a small height in such a way that I might accumulate all those intervals of time that elapse between the arrival of the heavy and light bodies respectively at their common terminus. So that this sum makes an interval of times which is not only observable, but easily observable. And so Galileo took two pendulums like this, a heavy one and a light one, and he set them dropping at the same time, right, to show that the acceleration due to gravity that the light pendulum will make and the one that the heavy pendulum will make will be exactly the same. Right? So if we let these go in sync, you'll see they should stay in sync. Whoops. Being starting to in sync. Let's try one more time. That was my fault. One, two, three, go. And if you watch, even though the white one sort of loses its swing a little more quickly, if you watch the starting time where they change direction and start their swing backwards, that they stay in sync. Now, you may not have thought that was a very impressive demonstration, right? But for Galileo, right, the fact that even though in this messy world, right, where there's the length of there's the differences in the weights, the differences in the amplitudes, and the differences in the air resistance of things, when certain properties remain the same and didn't vary, right? Those types of experiences were the more important ones. One of the things you may want to ask yourself when you're doing the experiments next time is, why did he think this experiment was interesting? What does this particular experiment show? And the pendulum was supposed to show that the object retained some of its motion, right? And that because the period remained the same and because it almost reached the same height as before, that indeed the law of inertia, that an object in motion tends to stay in motion, is correct. And since pendulums of different masses have the same period, that the acceleration of different weights, right, was the same. I'll skip over that one as well. Right. The next experiment was Galileo's inclined plane. Right. Let me read you a comment that the famous philosopher Immanuel Kant, right, made about Galileo's inclined plane experiment. It's on your syllabus. I thought it was so important. It's sort of the basic idea of the scientific method. When Galileo caused balls, the weights of which he had previously determined, to roll down an inclined plane, a light broke upon all students of nature. They learned that reason has insight only into that which it produces after a plan of its own, and that it must not allow itself to be kept, as it were, in nature's leading strings, but must itself force nature to give answers to questions of reason's own determining. So the scientific method doesn't involve just sort of looking and seeing what's there. It involves sort of forcing nature by purifying it and carefully controlling the variables, right, to isolate out one form. Right? You almost get the image in Kant's quote, you know, of putting nature to the rack, right, of, you know, forcing it to give up its secrets. Right? And the idea of the inclined plane was to slow down that motion. Right? Again, you may ask, if Galileo is interested in how fast objects fall when you drop them from a tower, you know, what's he doing instead of dropping objects? What's he doing rolling objects down an inclined plane? Again, it lessens the effect of the air resistance, right? Although there are other causes, other extraneous causes introduced, like the effect of rolling and the friction of the ball on the wood, right? But the main thing that it did was slow down the motion, whereas that motion that was so fast you drop the object off of a tower, right? The motion that we see when we roll the ball down the plane will be a little bit slower enough to measure. And this is going to be the other element that Galileo introduced into the scientific method. Not only did we isolate out each pure form, but by introducing a mathematical analysis of those forms, the workings of the world could be revealed to follow certain basic mathematical laws. When Galileo looked at what we saw just qualitatively, the ball getting faster, and instead saw that it was following certain mathematical laws, which it followed invariably and always, he felt as if he were sort of getting into the very secrets of the universe, He would say that the language with which God has written the universe, is the language of mathematics. And so let's look at Galileo's experiment, with the inclined plane. We're going to just roll a ball down the plane and see how it accelerates. At first, I'm just going to roll it down once so you can just sort of get an idea of how it rolls. Maybe you could catch it at the end. So let's first just take a peek at it qualitatively and just see what happens. You can see that it's getting faster as it rolls down. And now we're going to see if we can do a little bit of measurement. There are two different methods that Galileo used to measure the time on this, and you'll try both of them out, or you have the opportunity to try both of them out at your seminars. The first one was using some timing instrument. Galileo used various different ones. He used his heartbeat. He used a pendulum. Our pendulum is a little bit too long. Its period is too long for us to use. And it also used just counting. You'll see that he also used a water clock, let water run into a container, and then just measured the amount of water in it to tell him how much time was in it. What I'm going to do is just do it fairly roughly and mark by sort of counting a cadence out myself. Galileo knew from his music experience that human beings were very good at counting in time and marching in time or keeping time in music, and that we could detect a difference of up to 1/64 of a second. So sometimes he just used a simple interval or simple counting to measure time. So I'm going to try that. And I'm going to mark where it is at each of those intervals. So I'm just going to go 1,000, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,001, 1,002, 1,003, 1,004, 1,005. So if we mark the places where more or less those were, Galileo noted an interesting relationship between them. That if this is what it went in 1 second, the amount increased, and it increased in a certain way that's represented for you up on the screen. The first interval is 1, and this one is about 3. The next interval is about 5, and the next interval is about 7. And he saw that was related to the square of the time. So here's how far it went in 1 second, which is 1. And here's how far it went in 2 seconds, which is 1 + 3 is 4. So it was related as the square of the time. 2 × 2 is 4. And then if we add the other 7 on, we get 9. It went this far in 3 seconds, which is 9 lengths, which is 3 squared. If we add the other 7 on, it went 16 units in 4, which is 4 squared. So this was the source of Galileo's famous square law, that the distance traveled was proportional to or varied with the square of the time. And it may not seem like a big deal to us, since we're used to doing this all the time, but to recognize that nature followed mathematical laws, that you could predict the world, you saw in Professor Guerra's lecture, him bringing up a computer program that modeled the universe, and he showed you exactly what the Mars was doing in the year 1610, or whenever Galileo took his observations. Galileo's recognition that nature follows exact mathematical laws and will follow them exactly as if it were constrained by those mathematical laws was the key to him being able to somehow program that computer so it would follow exactly the same laws that the universe followed. In some sense, Galileo began a movement that would allow you to, in some sense, take the springs of the mechanics of the universe, the very laws that govern the universe, and stick them in that little computer, so that computer could simulate exactly what Mars was doing in 1610. an amazing amount of power, right, over the universe to figure out what laws constrained it and to allow us to manipulate and control them. Right? Let's try the other method that Galileo used to do this experiment. Another way he did is just arrange, we'll get rid of these ones. And here I'd like you to help me a little bit. What he did is have, he had people sort of call out as it passed each one of these marks, right? So as you see it pass each one of these bricks, I'd like you to go 1, 2, 3, 4. So when it passes this one, say 1. When it passes that one, say 2. It may help, since you, the people on this side, you're seeing it at a very extreme angle. Maybe we'll leave you guys out, right? The people on this side of the room, right? On my right, let them do it. All right, so when it gets to here, just say 1. When it gets to there, say 2. Yeah, you had to start going a lot faster, right? One of the problems, right? Could you just hit the right arrow on the keyboard? And hit it one more time. So that shows you sort of what we were doing. Galileo actually had a ramp, we think, right? Although this isn't the actual ramp, it's a facsimile, in which he had little bells, which when the ball passed the bells, it would ring the bell, right? And he was able to slide them around. One of the things that you can try to do in your seminars is see if you can move yourselves around so that that timing, instead of it getting faster, that the timing was regular. And now if we place our marks, where we're at the places that we measured before, right? Now, if I roll it down and you count out as it passes each of the marks, right, it should sound more regular. It should sound like a regular cadence because it's following that square law. Yeah, and you may want to notice something. This would be interesting for you to talk about in your lectures. Did you see, since you knew it, you were supposed to say 4 there, right? We tend to sort of wait, right, and make it come out right, right? So one of the things you want to ask yourself is when you try to do these, you'll find if you know what you're supposed to get, it's not easy to get it to come out the way it's supposed to, right? So you should ask yourself, you know, how does the scientific method really arrive at objective truth, right? Are we getting nature to reveal its real answers, or do we already know the answer in advance, and are we sort of imposing that answer upon it? Yeah, I think we're done with that. Right, that's the water clock that Galileo used. Right, I want to talk about the third type of experiment that Galileo used. Galileo used inclined planes to do two different types of things. He used it to measure the rate of motion, as we just saw. And he also used inclined planes to study projectile motion. Right, we're going to throw some balls here first. Projectile motion is just the motion that objects take when you throw them through space, when you project them through space. Right? Whoops, that's okay. Now watch the shadow. Watch the shadow to see the path that the ball takes. Right? And if you see the variety of paths that they take, one of Galileo's greatest discoveries was that all of the various different paths that moving objects can take through space, right, all share a certain mathematical feature. They're all what are called parabolas. Right, this shows you sort of all the different paths that an object can take if you throw it into the air, right, from throwing it way up in the air to throwing it sort of more directly horizontal. This is Galileo, remember, is drawing from his notes of the different types of paths that thrown objects can take. Right? And this is the parabolic shape that you can see by squirting a hose, is what you're seeing there, a hose squirting in the water. If you've seen, you know, somebody shooting the hose up in the water, right? That shape that it takes is a parabola. Mathematicians had long known, right, that parabolas had a particular property where they were particular sections of a cone or conic sections. So if you take a slice through a cone, other slices of cone are circles, and some of them are ellipses if you take it in a different way. And Kepler, remember, at the same time, was discovering that another conic section, the ellipses, were the key to the secret of the orbits of the planets. So again, the recognition that old mathematical knowledge was somehow unlocking the keys to the universe was very important at the time. And a number of the great scientists of the scientific revolution, like Newton and Kepler and Galileo, were even sort of number mystics, right? That there was some secret to certain numbers and some secret to certain mathematical forms. Galileo's experiment, because it's very difficult to be regular, as you saw as we were throwing it, you know, we couldn't get it at the same angle and the same force every time. Galileo used his inclined plane to control the speed of the objects that he was projecting into the air, and since you don't want to worry about it going up and then coming down, right, he sent them off horizontally, right, into the air, right? And you can see that the shape that it follows there is more or less a parabola as well. Right, here's a picture of Galileo's notes on the experiment that you can try to do next time, right, of dropping it from different heights and seeing the different paths that the parabola would take. Right? I want to do this experiment for you now, right? Because the key to understanding the parabola, right, was to see that that just as the scientific method meant purifying the appearances and separating out one form from another, and just as Galileo latched on to the period, the constancy of the period of the pendulum, because it didn't vary, right, it allowed the scientists to understand that pure form in separation from the mass of the bob or the amplitude of the swing. So the key to Galileo's understanding of motion was seeing that the vertical component of motion and the horizontal component of motion were absolutely independent. Right? That when you throw an object into the air, it will always fall at the same rate, no matter how fast or soft you throw it. And when you throw it, right, it will always go the same horizontal rate that it left your hand at. It will continue in the motion at the same speed, independently of how it's falling. And so let me demonstrate that to you. We're going to drop we're going to shoot an object off the little ramp here. Let me put this over here so our balls don't go skittling across the stage. And what I'm going to do is drop this ball exactly when it comes off the ramp. And what you should be listening for, it'd be hard to watch, you may not see it too well, but listen for the sounds of the two balls hitting the ground, right? And see, does the one that's shooting across, does it take longer to hit the ground than the one that's just taking the straight route, just falling straight down? Let's try it. And if you heard them, I couldn't hear any difference between them. Let's try it one more time. The ball was completely unaffected by the horizontal motion, right? When it got to the end of this ramp, it continued in motion at the same speed that it had reached at the end of the ramp, and then it started falling. Right? So if I were to shoot a gun, right, horizontally and drop that at the same time, right, even though it would land way far away, right, the bullet would be falling at exactly the same rate and would hit the ground at exactly the same time that hit the ground. Right? In some sense, that illustrates the essence of the scientific method, right? That the two motions are independent. They can be studied separately. You can take apart the world and study it separately. You can study the vertical motion and the horizontal motion separately without them affecting each other, without them, you know, sort of messing up each other. That the world was sort of built out of pieces. The world was modular. You could understand it by taking apart the pieces and studying them separately. And the result of the complex world that we saw was just the interrelationship of those simple motions. Right, so the motions that we're going to see in a second, you can see that the horizontal motion remains constant. That's the arrow that's pointing to the right, all the way. And its speed as it falls accelerates, right, in accordance with that square law that we saw before. Right, just to illustrate the parabolic motion a little bit more for you, there's some other experiments that you can perform in seminar next time, right? But we're just going to drop a few balls down there so you can get an idea of what the parabolic motion looks like, right? So as it's scooting down here, right, you'll get that parabolic motion, right, because the horizontal speed will be constant, right, depending upon whatever speed it reaches, right? Whereas the vertical motion will be accelerating at exactly the same rate that dropped objects would accelerate. Try some metal balls. And probably I'll just do this one more time. You'll see it better when you do it in your, for yourself in seminar tomorrow. Right, but it may not seem too impressive to you, right? But Galileo recognized, right, that because that was true, right, because the horizontal motion and the vertical motion varied independently, that those simple mathematical laws, right, that we that he had started to discover would be able to predict all of these complex paths, all the different types of curves that you saw objects taking. So that if we throw an object up in the air, right, once it leaves our hand, or once it leaves the cannon, it continues horizontally at the same rate. The horizontal arrow stays the same, right? Slows down as it's going up at exactly the same rate that it accelerates downward. That's why the two sides of the parabola are identical. Right, so you can see that if you shot the gun just purely horizontally, if there was no gravity, right, it would go straight out at exactly the same speed that it shoots out when you shoot it in gravity. And as we showed you, right, that if you drop the object, it falls at exactly the same rate that the shot object falls. Right? So the two vertical and horizontal components are exactly identical to our parabola. And you can see that if we perform some of the experiments you heard in the reading for Professor Guerra's lecture, right, of dropping the ball from the moving ship of the mast, you'll see that when you drop an object from a moving object, once you drop it, it continues to move at the speed of the object at a constant speed, but accelerates downward, and you get another parabola. Right? Here's our famous example of dropping the ball from the mast of the ship. And you'll see that the ball continues in motion. If the ship was moving, it continues in motion with the ship and then accelerates downward, giving the same parabolic shape. And here's a neat example. If you throw an object straight up in the air in a moving truck, the object will go up and come down in the truck. If you were on the truck, you would see it going straight up and straight down. But viewed from the side, you would see the nice parabola. Right, so this is a Picasso painting, right, a cubist picture of a Picasso painting. Right? And in some sense, this illustrates the basic idea of the scientific method that we've been illustrating, right? That science breaks down the complex perceptions that we perceive as a whole in the world and isolates out one thing or another, just the horizontal component, just the vertical component, just the gravity, get rid of the friction. Right? Just look at the period of the pendulum and don't talk about its amplitude or its weight. Picasso sort of caricatured, or almost in some sense made fun of, right, that method of science by breaking up our views of the object into the various different isolated forms and then putting them back together all akimbo or humble jumble, right, to sort of suggest that maybe when science does that to the world, right, so even though this method was madly successful, we're going to start asking the question, what effect does that have on our view of the world? Right? And Picasso and other postmodern thinkers, right, we're going to suggest that it leaves out certain aspects of human nature. This is a picture from Blake's The Ancient of Days, right, that illustrates Galileo's claim that the mathematics is the language with which God has written the universe. Right, there's the creator sketching out the world according to mathematical principles. That's a compass with which he's drawing out the world on the basis of these laws. Right, so the world follows these mathematical laws, just like Professor Guerra's simulation, right, follows the laws that we programmed into it. So in some sense, God programmed the world, right, with the laws of nature, these mathematical laws, and that's why the world runs the way it does, and Galileo was the first person to sort of decipher the secret of figuring out what the program was. And I want to talk a little bit briefly now about in the few minutes that we have left, about the effects that viewing the world in this way has on how we see the world. Right, there's a quote again on the outline that suggests that, maybe when we look at the world this way, it leaves something out, right? The real conflict between science and religion, right, it's going to turn out, may not be, right, that the sun is the center of the solar system rather than the earth. And we'll see that it may not even be, whether the evolution is the source of living organisms, right, or whether God is the source of all living organisms in a special creation. When the Pope re-examined the Galileo case, right, he admitted that it was a mistake to judge Galileo's science on the basis of a rigid interpretation of Scripture. But at the very same time, he did say that viewing the world in terms of purely science, denying the existence of the soul, right, denying the existence of a type of unity to the human being, right, that is lost by separating out the human being into all its individual parts and all its individual forms, as we saw Galileo doing, maybe losing something. Right? So he said, how are we to reconcile the explanation of the world, beginning with the level of elementary entities and phenomena, with a recognition of the fact that the whole is more than the sum of the parts? So the Romantic poets were some of the first to recognize this, and I have a little quote from John Keats that's fairly famous, right? That asks, does science give us a true view of the beauty of nature, right? And the importance and the dignity of the human being, right? He said that do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy. Right? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. Right? Here he's referring to Newton, who had discovered in the same way, right? Sort of another metaphor for Galileo's separation of the forms, is the way in which Newton took light and saw that the single white light that we saw can actually be separated into all the various different forms or frequencies of light that are present in it, and seeing that the rainbow was just the result of the mixture of all those forms. There was this awful rainbow once in heaven. We knew her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalogue of common things. Right? Philosophy, right, will quip an angel's wings, conquer all her mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air, the gnomed mind, unweave a rainbow. Right? So the question we have to ask is this new scientific method that allows Galileo to unlock the mathematical secrets of the universe, and which is eventually responsible for all the technology that we have in this world now, does it give an adequate account of the human being? Right? And as one small illustration, right, let me just give you some hints as to how to interpret the reading that you'll have for tonight. Right? In some sense, breaking everything down to its simple forms, right, treats the world as if it were a machine, right, treats the world as if it were like this locomotive, like a mechanism. You know, it's natural for us, because these mechanisms appear to work for a purpose, right? It's natural for us to sort of attribute to them a soul, right? Attribute to them a mind or a nature or a purpose. Right? So, you know, as a child, we'll look at the mechanism of the train, and because it moves down the road, you know, we'll assume that it has a spirit or a soul, like Thomas the Tank Engine. But in fact, we can see that its action is caused merely by the relation of these independently functioning parts. The reading that you'll have for next time from the Assayer, right, which was Galileo's sort of first expression of this mechanistic philosophy, right, in 1623, it sort of spelled out the implications of using this scientific method and separating the relative from the absolute compared to our perception of physical things. Right, just as we see that when we're tickled with a feather, right, that the tickle isn't really in the feather. Right? The tickle just produces a feeling in us. Right? The tickle of the feather is what he calls the second type of property, a secondary property. On the feather, all that really exists in the feather are the chemical structures of the atoms and molecules that make up the feather. Right? So in the same way, right, all of the feelings that we normally attribute to the external world, right, the blue of this chair, right, the sound of my voice, right, the taste of sugar, right, the smell of a rose, right, all of those things we think are in the object outside of us, and we attribute much of the beauty and the wonder and the value of the universe to them. Galileo, in the reading that you'll have for next time, is going to argue that if we apply that same method of separating out the relative from the absolute, we'll find that just as we discover that the tickle of the feather is not in the feather, so we'll discover that most of the sensible properties, right, that endow the world with much of its value and beauty and grandeur for us are not in the world itself, right? That the tree that falls in the forest, right, when no one's around to hear it, it makes primary properties, right? It makes vibrations of air, right? Those separately understandable components of physical motion still exist, right? But the sound, right, its aroma, right, the color of the branches, right, their texture as you feel them with your fingers, when we're not there to look at them, when the tree falls or exists in the forest, when we're not there to look at it, Much of what we attribute its beauty to is not there. Right? So what you should think about in your seminars is not only does the scientific method work and how does it work, but ask yourself, what are the implications of accepting this scientific method for understanding the beauty of the natural world and understanding the dignity of the human soul? Thank you.